Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Mike, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Tim. Great to be on the show with you again.
And again is the operative word. I'm going to let the audience in on a little secret. This is actually a take two on this podcast, which we recorded, I guess, just before the new year, but had some technical issues. So we're redoing it. And actually, we got an interesting topic that may have benefited from the few days off, because it turns out that the Russian premier or whatever, Medvedev, has been making some threats regarding the topic that we're going to discuss today, which is hypersonics. So with that, Mike, Happy New Year, and why don't we get started?
Yeah, let me give a little technical background for the audience about what we mean when we're talking about hypersonics. And I think we're going to return to this topic probably throughout the course of the podcast, because it hits a lot of different areas. Hypersonics, by the name itself, kind of gives a clue to what we're talking about. It's an aircraft or vehicle, and in this context, we typically mean a missile, that flies at speeds of at least Mach 5, so five times the speed of sound, so hypersonic. And I should probably have these things fully memorized, but I recall, you know, there's been research into hypersonic technology for many years by the U.S. and other companies. I think the X-15, if I'm getting it right, was a hypersonic aircraft the U.S. did back in the 60s. So this is not, the concept is not new, but the interest, I think, is kind of heating up a bit more, because the main point, I think, of our podcast today is that hypersonic missiles have actually, allegedly, been deployed by Russia and China. But the United States, though it has spent many years in hypersonic research, does not actually have a deployed missile system. So if you are, you know, in the sort of world of strategic power competition, this kind of lends itself to, and I'm not the one who first thought of this, I've seen some articles on this, but hypersonics, is this another Sputnik moment? Which is exactly the thing that, like, DARPA and a lot of our defense, you know, R&D shops are created to prevent in the United States, is no more strategic surprise like Sputnik when the Soviets launched the first satellite. And so you'll see a lot of that in the media. And that's kind of why we're talking about this on the podcast, is that Russia and China have deployed operational hypersonic systems. And the U.S., though the U.S. has been in this area in terms of research for a long time, does not actually have an operational capability. And so that's what we hear about from, you know, commentators, from defense officials, and in Congress. You know, are we falling behind?
Yeah, you know, and I mean, it's certainly something that's caught the attention of folks on the Hill. I note that the recently passed omnibus has about $4.5 billion, that's billion with a B, total, you know, sort of related to hypersonic programs. But also is interesting that, you know, I think there's still a lot of discussion out there in sort of defense intellectual circles, if you will, as to what the use case for these weapons is in sort of the U.S. context, where I think they're envisioned pretty much strictly as a conventional strike capability, while the Russians and the Chinese, I think, may have different plans for their systems. You know, if you could give me a little sense, Mike, as to why is it that the U.S. has sort of fallen behind on hypersonics? What is sort of driving sort of the relative lack of effort as compared to our Chinese and Russian competitors?
I would say I don't think the pedal has come off the gas in terms of R&D. So the U.S. has done that for many, many years. But as you've, I think, already previewed, there hasn't really been a decision that the U.S. government, you know, needs a hypersonic capability such that it would become, as we call it in the DoD sector, you know, a program of record. So there's been R&D for many years. There are, I think, multiple R&D programs out there now, but there hasn't sort of been the strategic driver about, is this the next class of missile? If so, you know, things just got real then. We got to make this, we got to field this. Not just have R&D, not just have tests, You know, we got to go beyond prototypes to actually fielding them. And that's why I think we're talking about this, is there's still some uncertainty on that, right? So there is money for R&D, and the U.S. has been doing that for many years. But there are strategic commentators who have said, you know, kind of two minds about this. One, this is maybe a game changer because of how hypersonic missiles work compared to ICBMs and ballistic missiles and cruise missiles. We could talk about that technology in a minute. And others that say it's really the same thing. It's just this, you know, if I have the capability with a hypersonic missile to launch a nuclear weapon, and China and Russia have the same thing, we're all in the same strategic boat we were before. It's not different. And that, I think, is why there's uncertainty here. As you said, Russia and China have been very clear that they have developed hypersonic missiles with the intention of them being, you know, having a nuclear warhead, nuclear capable. The U.S. publicly, at least, has said, and my experience with this back in the DoD days were what is now, I think, called conventional global strike. It was prompt global strike. It's still the idea, as you said, it's conventional. It's the ability to strike anywhere in the world, but only with conventional weaponry. It's not nuclear armed. And the Navy has that program right now. And that's what we had in the 2000s. So, you know, 20 years ago, that's kind of where the thinking was. But now there's some other programs out there. I think you and I talked the other week about the Army recently issued an award, I think, to Raytheon and others in November 2022 for their program, which is launched, I believe, sort of from a regular missile on sort of essentially the back of a vehicle. And that is still going to be a prototype, though, right? So we've got all these prototype programs out there. Nothing is set to be fielded as an operational, you know, missile for a long time. I think the Army one, as I recall, it's a long-range hypersonic weapon. We love our acronyms. So that's LRHW. But they, when they announced the contract awards in November, said the goal was to field a prototype in FY 2023. That's now. And then transition to a program of record in 2024, 1 year later, which is coming from the acquisition world. Yeah, that's very aggressive. Right. You know, people have probably seen in the media that some hypersonic tests that we've done and that other companies have done have in some ways been failures, but, you know, you learn from them, but, you know, there's still a lot to learn in this. So yeah, we've got a couple different programs, and I should mention some other. DARPA has like a handful of what they're also doing research. So there's a bunch of hypersonic programs in the Department of Defense, you know, with different owners.
So why don't we take a step back though for a second? And, you know, I think you sort of obviously went through what is the central feature of a hypersonic, which is the fact that it's sort of Mach 5 or higher. But what are the particular other attributes of the weapons currently being fielded by the Russians and the Chinese that makes American military planners nervous and perhaps desirous of getting a similar capability for the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a good reminder, Tim. I should have put that on earlier in the conversation, and we've talked about this before. You know, beyond just the fact that they travel at Mach 5 or greater speed of sound, there's other aspects to what we talk about with a hypersonic vehicle. So the one I'm familiar with, coming from, as I mentioned, you know, time supporting the Treaty Compliance Office in the Department of Defense. And when I say treaty compliance, I mean what used to be the START Treaty and then the new START Treaty. That's the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaties. Those are all about ballistic missiles and their launchers and nuclear armed warheads. And that's a longstanding arms control agreements between the U.S. and Russia. And I mentioned those because the technology that I was initially familiar with from where I used to work for hypersonic weapons was the hypersonic glide vehicle approach. So you just say HGV sometimes. And in that scenario, what you do is you take a ballistic missile. So that goes up, you know, to our listeners on an arch, you know, parabolic trajectory that comes back down to Earth. That's how ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, have always operated. So a hypersonic glide vehicle approach would be you launch essentially an ICBM, and then it will release the hypersonic vehicle, which will then drop back down to Earth. But because it is a hypersonic glide vehicle, once it's released from the rocket, you can then control it to the target. And that's sort of what some would say is why this is a game changer from traditional ballistic missiles, because while it may be launched up like a ballistic missile, when it's coming back down, it can be guided to a target, and it is traveling, you know, at Mach 5 or greater. Let me also give another example, hypersonic missile, and then we'll talk about the challenges of both these. The other one is sort of the hypersonic cruise missile, which is similar to cruise missiles today, but it's traveling much faster, hypersonic speeds. And so cruise missiles, you know, for our listeners, that's low to the ground, right? Maneuverable, but it's traveling so fast that radar is going to have a hard time detecting it until it gets closer.
And so for our listeners who've been following the Ukraine war, is the hypersonic weapon that was used early on in the conflict, was that the Kinzhal? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, the Kinzhal, as I recall, so the Russians, let's talk about that. That's a maneuvering air-launched ballistic missile approach.
Okay.
So it maneuvers to the target. It is, I believe, like a modified Iskander missile, or Alexander, okay, right? Which was, I recall, sort of one of their shorter-range ballistic missiles. And so that was fielded in the Ukraine, according to news reports, though it sounds like its success rate wasn't all that great. So that's been fielded out there. There are others that I don't believe have been used in the Ukraine that the Russians have. So the Avangard is an example, the first one I mentioned, which is a hypersonic glide vehicle launched from an ICBM. So that's the traditional one I'm used to, is launch an ICBM up, and then it releases a hypersonic glide vehicle. They also have the Zircon, which is a ship-launched hypersonic cruise missile. So that's, again, just like America has cruise missiles today, we have our Tomahawks. It's the same idea, where it would be, it's a cruise missile launched out of a vertical launch tube, but unlike cruise missiles that everyone has, you know, the forces have today, it's going to travel at hypersonic speeds. And that's the challenge. And so we allude to this, but for all of these approaches, the challenge is the speed of the weapon, which means it compresses your timeline for response. So, you know, will traditional radar or ballistic missile defense, or missile defenses generally, pick it up? Potentially not, right? So short flight path. And then also, again, because these are maneuverable, it's the unpredictable flight path. That's the advantage over, you know, the strategic weapons I mentioned before, is that you can guide it to its target. So, you know, the opponent doesn't really know where it's going to go. So that's the challenge with this type of technology. But again, as you and I had said earlier, you know, there's two minds of that. Some say that's a game changer. And others say, no, you approach this the same way that you've approached ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons for many, many years. But the fact that that's, you know, not agreed upon is, I think, why this is such a sensitive area, right? And we should talk about China's technology, too, since we hit Russia. Let me just mention China, right? So they, publicly available information on what China has done is sort of less open than Russia, because Russia has, you know, a tendency to sort of, you know, tell everyone and demonstrate, we use this technology in Ukraine. Like, they want people to know. China doesn't really always announce their tests, per se. They don't really want to publicize it as much. Russia, I think, wants to get credit. So there are stories that China has already tested a nuclear capable hypersonic glide vehicle. That's the one I mentioned, you know, going up on an ICBM coming down, using a Long March rocket. And that they may have also already tested successfully hypersonic vehicles using the DF-17, and that's a medium-range ballistic missile. So we're kind of in the shorter category. And then, similar to what Russia's been doing, they've also been working on cruise missile, hypersonic cruise missile technology, which, to the points we've talked about, if there was ever tension in Taiwan Strait, you know, cruise missiles, you know, often are launched from, they can be launched from land, but they'll often be launched at sea from a frigate or a corvette or submarine. So they've kind of, China has also kind of hit all the main buckets, if you will. ICBM, you know, hypersonic technology, so long range, medium range, and allegedly cruise missiles, hypersonic cruise missiles. So they've kind of hit all of those. And again, back to the point we made at the beginning, both Russia and China have allegedly fielded all of these. Like, the weapon systems are out there and are operational. The U.S. is currently in prototype phase, or even just about to get into prototype phase, with a couple programs.
So my understanding is that U.S. planners are particularly concerned about these weapons in a naval context, particularly out in the Western Pacific. For many years now, I know that people in the media and then elsewhere in the government have been talking about the DF-21 China carrier killer missile. Now, is that a hypersonic weapon, or is that an earlier generation? And that we're talking about something altogether new here.
I believe that sort of takes a similar approach. So that might be a variation on hypersonic technology. You can adapt a lot of this stuff to hypersonics, depending on what you're delivering. I think the main differentiator between the U.S. and Russia and China is it going to be armed with a nuclear warhead or not? And this is probably the challenge for why the U.S. is maybe a little further behind, is the desire in the U.S. is to not have the technology be nuclear capable, then you need greater accuracy because you're not going to rely on the explosion of a nuclear warhead to damage whatever the target is. So you the U.S. is, as I understand, looking for greater accuracy and greater control, which makes this harder. So really more of a pinpoint strike, whereas Russia and China, you know, potentially every one of these things they developed could be nuclear capable. And again, just like throughout the whole Cold War period, I mean, that's a strategic concern, is you don't actually know if one of these, when they're launched, has a nuclear warhead or not. That's always going to be the challenge there. So I think it's less about the missile that we're describing as the carrier killer missile versus some of these other ones, and more about, is it a nuclear armed one or not? Because the U.S. will go into the, it currently would go into the situation with, we don't arm any of this stuff with nuclear weapons. China and Russia, all of their stuff that we described here is nuclear capable.
And it is interesting because the use case question does come up, because if you look at the targets that were struck by the Russian hypersonics, there was really no need in any of the cases that I've been able to understand for why you would need to use that particular type of weapon. You know, they were not in an area of particularly dense air defense, nor were they even necessarily all that valuable. And so I guess it maybe was, you know, a terror demonstration. But I think that, you know, that does play into, I think, the caution on the part of some American planners that, you know, we want to make sure that as we're spending all this money, that we're, you know, developing the proper target sets for them to be employed against.
Yeah. And in the Ukraine context, I believe, I think, as you've already put it, that the technology was not used necessarily to hit sites, you know, of huge strategic importance. It was potentially Russia showing off the fact that they had fielded a hypersonic capability. They probably could have tried to accomplish the same thing with traditional missiles. But as we've seen, the Ukrainian forces have been pretty surprising. And I'm not aware that it was any edge in missile defense technology the Ukrainians had that caused some of the failure rates among the Russian rockets. I think it's just that the Russian rockets just were not as great as the Russians thought. I wouldn't take this as, this is an example that hypersonic missiles are a failure, right, is the long point, right? Because there've been other successful tests, both by China and I think even the US, but it may show that the Russian, at least the Iskander one that they developed, right, was not all that great. But take the China, the carrier killing missiles you're talking about, which I believe that is hypersonic technology. It's not the other ones we were talking about per se, but the idea is still that it will be maneuverable, and that's the challenge. So I guess I would put the carrier killer missile in the hypersonic bucket. So we should probably put that all together, right? So if you go to that example, yes, the carrier killer missiles have been a big concern for the US. It's for the same reasons though, right? It can be maneuvered to the target, and it will travel at high speed. So that's also, yeah, that's a hypersonic delivery vehicle. And the U.S. doesn't have that. We don't have U.S. hypersonic killer missiles right now. The programs that the Navy and the Army and the Air Force and they're all developing, there is the possibility, I recall, to launch like the Prompt Global Strike the Navy has. That can be launched from destroyers, but it could also be launched from our Ohio ballistic missile class submarines or the Virginia class submarines, which are the cruise missile submarines. So if you take that approach, you'd say that, yeah, the U.S. government, that's foreign defense, may also be developing a carrier killer type missile if you develop a hypersonic vehicle that is launched from destroyers or subs, right? It's the same idea. It would be, you know, it doesn't need to be ICBM range per se. It's the speed at which it travels and the maneuverability, so you can't counter it very well, to make it a threat to carriers. But as you said, the difference is China's already got it. And Russia and U.S. is still an R&D project.
Right. But at the same time, you know, the U.S. has, I mean, we are the country that's relying on aircraft carriers as the chief, you know, method of our surface power projection by the Navy. So, but, you know, look, obviously, this is an area where the Congress and the executive branch are going to continue to invest resources. It's something where I think that the U.S. clearly has some catching up to do. But I also think that having looked at this over the past couple of weeks, that we have not reached a point where it's a Sputnik moment, that we have sort of left ourselves exposed and vulnerable in some profound way because we are not as far along as our competitors with this. That's just my own sense.
I think that's
others
fair.
Are free to disagree, but that's where I come down on this.
And I think that's where sort of the tension lies, right? Is that some may consider this a Sputnik moment. I agree with you. I don't think that this was not a strategic surprise because the U.S. has been doing hypersonic R&D for years. It's not a situation where another great power competitor came up with technology that we just weren't even addressing. But the concern, I think, from a strategic stability standpoint is that other countries have fielded it and we've not fielded it. Do we need to field it? That's part of the discussion you said about what's going on in Congress and another scrutiny on this is, well, we've got this R&D work. Are we going to turn it into a program of record? That, I think, is now what's been happening, maybe in the last year or two, right, is the push, you know, to sort of take these things that have been ongoing R&D projects and recognizing that, well, if other countries actually have fielded these, we haven't fielded anything. So it's not the strategic surprise of a Sputnik moment, but it's also it's got to stop being R&D and become live. And that's right. New. That's where we are. Or that's where the U.S. is trying to get. But I want to make one note for our listeners, because this is relevant for a lot of sort of companies that are in the aerospace and defense space, is that I have heard from the government, you know, this has been public pronouncements on this, right, is that there's not really a hypersonic industrial base set up in the U.S. It's a sort of, you know, field these things if they're going to become a program of record. So that just gets to the point I mentioned about the Army hypersonic vehicle. If that's going to become a program of record in 2024, you know, now we're trying to move these things faster, but some would say you haven't really set up the industrial base to support it because we haven't been fielding these things. It is a new class of missile. It's going to turn from an R&D project into fielding them out there. Related to the conversation we had on the Ukraine conflict just a few weeks ago, you know, the U.S. has been drawing down its supplies of other, you know, conventional munitions and the rest to support our allies in the Ukraine. Is the industrial base, the defense industrial base, ready today? And if not, what needs to be done to actually have the U.S. field an operational hypersonic missile? And my understanding is there's some doubts that currently suppliers and the components, the subassemblies, that's not really been created yet. The 2024 deadline that the Army has to actually go to an operational capability, as I said, I think is very aggressive, just for general, you know, acquisition program reasons, but also because of that. We don't really have the support structure for this stuff yet. So that's interesting, I think, just to note when we're talking about if this is really going to be the next class of missile, then you need to agree, you know, in the U.S., there needs to be the supply chain for it, because we haven't had to do that. It's just been an R&D project.
And I think that, you know, that's the other, you know, issue going forward is how many of these could we even afford to buy? You know, at some point, the stress on the budget in terms of acquisition, you know, manpower and all the other, you know, support costs, when you try to do everything and you're not funding everything at the level it's supposed to be, you end up sort of shortchanging everything. But that's a topic for another Friday afternoon, I think.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll pick this up again. We just wanted to put that out there for everyone that hypersonics is another critical technology out there. And there are a lot of things behind it. And we'll probably return to this, you know, in some other topic, some other sessions in the future. But that's the technology. That's where we are. You know, China and Russia have fielded operational missiles already, and the U.S. is starting to more aggressively try to field an operational capability. And the last point I just made, but the supply chain and the infrastructure in the U.S., there's a question if it could really support that. And as you said, Tim, yeah, what are the decisions going to be made? Like, how many, it becomes a program of record, how many missiles will be ordered in a given year? These decisions haven't been made yet. And so that's why we wanted to bring this topic up, because it's one area where the competitors, the global competitors, have already fielded it. We just don't field this in the U.S. And are we going to field it, and at what level?
Yep. And I think, you know, we should, you know, sort of pay attention to this as sort of budget and hearing season get underway on the Hill. And then also I'm going to be looking and see whether this comes up in this select China committee that Congressman Gallagher has been tapped to lead over in the House. So I think there's more to come on this topic. But with that, have a great afternoon, Mike, and talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.